I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When the statue of Saddam Hussein fell yesterday, America's Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld hastened to compare it to the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the end of another evil empire. Many in the Arab world reject that simple calculus. They've been jolted from an initial sense of pride, watching the determination of Arab soldiers who slowed those American tanks with their Kalashnikovs, to the shame of seeing those U.S. Marines sprawled in the embroidered chairs in the ruins of Baghdad palaces. Today, Arab writers and academics continue to express their anger at what they call an occupation and ask new questions about what comes next, not just for Iraq and its neighboring states like Syria, but in larger terms for the entire region. Connection listeners, how is the fall of Saddam Hussein being seen in the Arab world? Is it likely to lead to change, to a spread of democracy? Or will Arab anger at the American occupation result in more resentment, more instability? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We thought we'd start today by touching down in the Gulf. Khaled Al-Maina, editor-in-chief of the Arab News, is joining us on the line from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And Francis Matthew, editor of the Gulf News, is joining us from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Khaled.
Thank you very much. Good to be there.
Maybe, Khaled, I can start with you. The lead editorial, if I have my facts right, in the Arab News in Saudi Arabia today talks about good riddance for Saddam Hussein, but then some real fears about what comes next. Is that a fairly accurate reflection?
Yes, I think people are a bit apprehensive in the region. While nobody was batting for Saddam all this time, people are a bit concerned about the future, and already as I speak to you, my man in Najaf spoke about Khoui being killed. This is the southern leader who was pro-American in certain ways, has just been stabbed an hour or two, maybe more. It's now confirmed, I think, and needs to be reconfirmed by some elements in Najaf. So that is a major problem for the Americans.
Let me stop you there, Khaled, because I need to know the significance of that. This is a Shiite cleric, fairly senior, who has apparently been assassinated in Najaf, a very, very holy city to the Shiites. But why is this particular man important?
He is important because he was able to, in the past, to combine and hold many of the people in the south in a cohesive group, and his death also would spark off maybe revenge killings. There will be a vacuum in leadership. He was a moderate. So what is needed in Iraq on all fronts now are moderate people, are people who are committed to that military gains will be translated into economic and political gains, not for themselves, but for the Iraqi people. Now, why are we apprehensive? Is that we fear that the United States might bring in, and out of goodwill maybe, people who have been outside for so long, who have been alienated, sitting in Washington and London and whiling their time away in cafes and restaurants, who have been far away. They will not be able to hold or be looked at in the same, with the same respect that people look at others. So that would cause a vacuum.
Francis Matthew of the Gulf News, tell me what your lead is in the paper this morning, if you would.
We ran with a story saying that it was a heartbreaking moment for Arabs to see the U.S. Marines going into Baghdad, not because it was the occupation by a foreign force, although that's a part of an emotion, mm-hmm. but mainly because of the shock of seeing a great Arab city, where the city of Harun Rashid and the source of so much strength over a thousand years and more of Arab history being taken apart in this way. One of the stories we ran inside, I think, sums up what I think is the way forward, which the Arab world needs to focus on. We all need to think about, quoting Dr. Abdelkhalik Abdallah, who said that the fall of Saddam is not the fall of Baghdad. It's not the occupation of Baghdad. It's the ending of a dictatorship. And I think that aspect is one which in particular, the Americans need to emphasize a lot more.
But would your readers in Dubai, for example, agree that it is a good thing that Saddam Hussein is no longer in charge of Iraq?
Yes.
But
his dictatorship and his regime has been particularly miserable, to use a very mild word for a very extreme situation.
So why is it that the Americans don't get a pat on the back for doing something that some people believe ought to have been done a long, long time ago?
I'm in danger of repeating something which we've all heard so often we tend to not listen to. They don't get the pat on the back because in the Middle East, the Americans are not trusted because of their unstinting support for Israel. And the suspicion is that now the politics take over in Iraq, that in some way Israel will come out a gainer out of this. Maybe the Iraqi people as well. We hope so very much. They cannot lose by the loss of Saddam. But if Israel is somehow in the driving seat on this, this is what the Arabs are watching with sort of expectation or terrible caution, waiting for something like that.
Khaled, help me with your perspective on this. If Israel is put in further into the driving seat, as Francis is describing here, I mean, there's another way of looking at it from this side of the ocean, and that is that the dictator, who is now no longer in charge of Iraq, is no longer sending checks for $10,000 to the families of suicide bombers, and maybe, in the long run, that will be a good thing.
Maybe it will not be a good thing. I mean, this is the perception of the people. It's not a question of sending checks. I think to the minds of many Arabs, liberals, secular, modern, conservative, the powder keg in the Middle East was not Baghdad. The powder keg in the Middle East is the occupied West Bank. And as Francis said, I mean, we may be in danger of repeating again and again, but in all honesty, if the United States is to be seen as an honest broker, it should shoulder its responsibility as an unstinted supporter of Israel to force the Israelis to accept some of the peace packages that have been offered in the past couple of years. And let me tell you, this myth about Arabs not accepting Israel has already disappeared. There's a new group of Arabs, young people, educated, politically savvy, computer savvy, who want to get on with their lives. They want to be Bill Gates and be captains of business industry. They don't want to throw bombs or grenades and all. So I think we've got to give them a chance. And the United States should now, after this turnover, and as you have moved heaven and earth to remove Saddam, I think you should move heaven and earth at least to implement United Nations resolutions that have been gathering dust. And this is where people say America speaks with a forked tongue, because on one hand, you have pushed all these kinds of resolutions on Iraq, but on the other hand, you just turn a blind eye to the oppression in the occupied West Bank.
Francis Matthews, certainly British Prime Minister Tony Blair has spoken numerous times in the past few weeks and months about the importance of making sure that activity, that the focus swings quickly to the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians after Iraq. What's that window in your view? I mean, there is still fighting going on in Iraq, and there may be for some months yet. So what's the timeline that you see there?
On the roadmap, the window is, I think, fairly long, since people have more or less switched off on that. Sharon is working hard to derail it. Bush has put out some contradictory statements, welcoming amendments or not. But a lot of the heat would come out of the suspicion if America had been clearer about the political route forward. I think the silence from America during the last months on Iraq and how the political entities would come together has allowed the suspicion to flourish. General Garner and his organization, which we don't know much about yet, the interim Iraqi authority, which again we don't know very much about, and the role of the UN, which has been described by President Bush as vital, but by Secretary Powell as vital but not central.
Right.
So all these three elements, who reports to who, who's in charge, is it General Franks going to run the place or the Iraqis and the Iraqi interim administration? If this had been clearer at the beginning, it would have been a much easier political start. And, I mean, one of the pleasures of being a journalist is to play what if General Franks and the Qatar headquarters had Iraqis standing up beside him, talking how they see the future and taking part in this process, again, the politics of the takeover would have been much clearer.
All right, Francis, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Francis Matthew is editor of Gulf News in Dubai. And Khaled Al-Maina, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Khaled is editor-in-chief of the Arab News, joining us on the line from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Let's go to the NPR studio in Washington now. Michael Hudson is taking his chair there. He's a professor of Arab Studies and professor of International Relations at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, Georgetown University. Michael, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
Have you had a chance to scan the editorials today and see the range of opinions?
Yes, I've had a chance to look at a little bit of this. If you're talking about the Arab world...
Yes, I am.
I think the ambivalence is perhaps the single best word to describe what I'm sensing. I think there's a very, on the one hand, a feeling that Saddam Hussein, the departure of Saddam Hussein is to be welcomed. He was not much liked. His regime was well known to be tyrannical and just generally troublesome. But on the other hand, and I think this is maybe the dominant view, there is a sense of deep shame, I think, and anger and frustration that an American army led by an American administration that is thought to have no particular love for the Arabs, marched up to Baghdad, doing tremendous destruction on the way, and did regime change, and even for a moment draped the statue of Saddam Hussein with an American flag. It was pretty painful, I think, and I think that's reflected in some of the opinion that you're seeing coming out of the Arab media now.
I suppose it's hard to fault the enthusiasm of the young Marine who might have thought that that was a good thing. And we hear it in other stories, too. People in Saddam City saying, you know, guys, take the American flags off your tanks. And mm-hmm. and the Marines, you know, not immediately responding as if they get what it means to the people in Baghdad.
Well, it's entirely understandable, I think, for the ordinary American soldier to, you know, to be doing such a thing.
Right.
But it is, I think, that even though it only lasted for a minute before I think some superior officers told him to get that thing off the statue fast, it nevertheless was there, and it's all over the place now. And it is an unfortunate bit of, you know, juxtaposition of an American hegemon sort of, you know, covering and then suffocating, as it were, an Arab leader who, although he was not much loved, was nevertheless in his last days, I think, increasingly seen as a hero in the Arab world, facing not a liberating army, but an imperialist army that wants to come and occupy one of the most important Arab countries.
All right, Michael, we'll pick that up when we come back. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255, a conversation this hour about reaction in the Arab world as this story unfolds. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. One of the miracles of web technology is that the day of and the day after, you get to see what's being written in newspapers right around the world. We're doing that today, trying to take the temperature of the Arab journalists and academics who are writing in response to the rapidly unfolding story in Iraq. Michael Hudson is with us for the hour. He's a professor of Arab Studies and International Relations at Georgetown University. He's also editor of The Middle East Dilemma, The Politics and Economics of Arab Integration. And let's actually go to the phone lines. Michael, just stand by for half a second. We're going to hear from Lisa, who's in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call today.
Yeah, go ahead.
Show. I have sort of a question and a comment that I'd like to make. I guess, you know, I agree that I think we need to get the Iraqi government set on the right path and get out of that country as quick as we can. My question is the belief in the Arab world that this is a war against Islam? You know, I watch the television, and it just seems like we can't do anything right with the protests that are going on. And because of that belief, is there anything short of actually pulling our support for Israel that we can do to turn the tide of hatred?
Well, there's a tough one for you, Michael.
Well, yeah, that's the $64,000 question, and Lisa has zeroed in on, I think, the most difficult problem facing the administration. In some quarters, I'm afraid, yes, this will be seen as a war against Islam. And the Bush administration has tried, but I'm afraid has not been very successful in trying to convince Muslim and Arab opinion to the contrary. And it is also true that by far the biggest irritant, to put it mildly, in the relationship between the U.S. government and the Arab world is the perception out there of a basic 100% U.S. partisanship with Israel, even the present very hard-line government of Sharon. I don't think it would be necessary, in order to try and reverse this unfortunate situation, that the United States would have to abandon Israel. But I think, as Mr. Matthew was saying earlier, it would certainly have helped matters a lot if the U.S. had indicated a more vigorous and even-handed approach to this ongoing and rather bloody Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So it is to be hoped, and I think Khaled al-Maina, who was speaking earlier, mentioned this, it is to be hoped that the U.S. will now turn its attention in a careful and thoughtful and objective way to trying to get the Palestinian-Israeli matter back on the tracks.
All right, Lisa, thanks very much for that call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're joined on the line now by Abdelbari Atwan, editor-in-chief of Al-Quds. That's London's Arab language newspaper. And Abdelbari Atwan has been with us a number of times before on The Connection. Welcome back.
Nice to talk to you.
Tell me what your lead editorial in Al-Quds is saying today, if you would, Abdel.
Well, actually, today we have pessimistic views when it comes to the future of Iraq after Saddam Hussein. So we predict post-Saddam Hussein era will be more difficult than the previous one. You know, to liberate Iraq, as the American and the British call it, it wouldn't be the easiest part of it. How to maintain peace, law and order in that part of the world, I think it will be the most difficult jobs because it takes more than troops, it takes more than patience and more than skills. And the other point, which is we predict that, you know, the Iraqi were divided when it comes to Saddam Hussein, but when it comes to the American and the British forces in their country, they could be united in this field. And the third, because I don't believe they will accept the, you know, occupation, as they call it in most of the Arab words. The third point, which, you know, there is a huge division among the opposition groups, external groups or internal groups, and there is inter-fighting among them, and we detect these kind of things. So it is just 2 days after the liberation of Baghdad, and we can see fighting each other and actually slanging each other. So I think the American job and the British job will be difficult, and it could be extremely dangerous, and we detected that there are some signs that Hezbollah of Iraq is emerging now, and the huge American, the huge Iraqi border with Iran and also with Syria, I think could be, you know, a transit or a gate for to smuggle arms and to smuggle volunteers in order to fight the British and the American troops in that part of the world.
Well, are you saying, though, then, that the Americans or the British need to run the sort of military occupation that we saw perhaps in the years after the Second World War with minimal involvement of the Iraqis, if choosing anyone in that country is likely to anger another sector of the population under the circumstances, given the fact that they're already there, does it mean that the occupation ought to be run without Iraqi involvement, at least in the near-term future?
Well, actually, the problem is, you know, Iraq is a very difficult and complicated country. It has a lot of sectarian groups or division. It has ethnic groups. It has, you know, Christian, Muslim, Kurd, Turkoman, Shia, Sunnah. So this kind of, you know, structure is difficult to maintain and difficult to please in the same time. And it is, we have to also to remember, it is a tribal society. So it is not like Germany or like Japan. You know, in Germany, for example, Christian forces are running a Christian country. In Japan, it is you know, different, also different story. So here, at least two nuclear bombs were used in that time. So it is scary and frightening. So in Iraq, this is a foreign troops. It is Christian troops representing Christian countries and occupying or trying to maintain peace in a Muslim country, in a tribal society, in Arab nationalistic bed, I mean, so or place. So I think that's because of these complications. I cannot see this kind of presence will be an easy ride, or I cannot see also the future of Iraq under the British and American administration will be a safe and stable and secure place. I would like to see some things in a different way. And so what I want to say that it's premature to rejoice, premature to actually judge the situation, because, you know, a few hundreds of people were dancing in the front of cameras and in a very artificial way, because those people definitely, they don't represent, you know, the 22 million Iraqis
people.
And they don't represent all parts of even Baghdad itself.
Let me stop you there. I want to see if we can get to Bob, who's called in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Bob, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I just had two quick questions. I hear comments from people in the Middle East that say, for example, that we shouldn't be there and that we should have left this up to the Iraqis themselves. But from what we've heard, if you stand up to Saddam Hussein, it's like signing your own death warrant. And it seems to me that when I hear comments like that, I think, gee, some of these people in the Middle East are perhaps there themselves their own worst enemies. And then how do the Arabs weigh 30 years of a brutal dictatorship against this three-week war so far? You know, everybody complains about the collateral damage, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, but if this works out for the best, isn't this better than, I mean, if Saddam Hussein, if he just died a natural death and then one of his sons took over, could be another 30 years of another brutal dictatorship. I'm really curious as to why, you know, they don't like Saddam, but maybe they would be content to live another 30 years
I take your point. I want to go to Michael Hudson first on that. Michael, I think that's a pretty clear question.
Yeah, it's two questions. We shouldn't be there. Well, yes. The reason we are there, I think, contrary to what we're saying, few people believe that we're really there to liberate the Iraqis. We have other interests. It has been said that that if broccoli were the main export crop of Iraq instead of oil, we might not be there either. And if we didn't suspect perhaps that Iraq had had weapons of mass destruction, although nobody has found any yet, we wouldn't be there either. So perhaps what we're seeing in the toppling of Saddam Hussein, this regime change, is in sort of an ironic way a kind of a collateral benefit for a project that has entirely different principle objectives. And I would hope, I think Abdul Bari is, you know, I'm afraid I share a great deal of his analysis and his pessimism, but I would hope, and I don't think it's impossible, that the next stable government, the next real government in Iraq, will be better than the one that is now in its dying days. And as for, if you're an Iraqi, how you weigh 30 years of Saddam's dictatorship against, you know, what may be dawning. Well, it's a fair question, and I think one has to, you know, certainly sympathize with the Iraqis. I know many Iraqis who are quite ambivalent about this. They are very happy that someone from the outside, the biggest power in the world, decided for whatever reason to come in, spending a lot of its money, spending a lot of treasure, some lives, and so forth, to rid them of this tyrant.
Michael, let's hear if we can from Abdul Bariatwan on this. You know, what What about the idea that you can call the U.S. forces occupiers, you can call them brutal, you can call them insensitive, but they got rid of a dictator who'd made life miserable for a nation for 30 years?
Yes, I do agree with Professor Hudson. I do agree with you. It is definitely a brutal dictator, and actually he has, or he had, the worst human rights records in the Middle East. He tortured, he killed, he gassed his people. No question about that. But the problem is, you know, the Americans, to present themselves as a liberator, and as they are, you know, now they didn't find any sign of weapon of mass destruction yet. And, you know, it is clear to everybody it is imperialistic war. They are there just for the oil and for to strengthen the Israeli position in the region. That's what's in the mind of the Arabs and Muslims all over the world. The other point which I would like to refer to, okay, if they are a liberator, if they are against dictatorship, we know that, you know, Saddam Hussein is not the only dictator. So if they don't complete this job, okay, if they started it, and if they say to Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, look, listen, you know, you are a dictator, you are trying to actually to organize some sort of succession to your son, and if they go to Bashar al-Assad of Syria, say, look, you know, your human rights, or your father, or your regime human rights record is as bad as Saddam Hussein. If they go to the Saudi, that you can't really, you know, take all these, the wealth of the country, and treat your people as if there is no people at all in the country. In this case, maybe, you know, people in the Middle East, and also if they go to the Israelis, say, enough is enough, you know, you are occupying other people's territories and threatening them, possessing weapon of mass destruction. In this case, maybe the American image in the eyes of the and the hearts of the Arabs and Muslims all over the world, it will be different. But as long as actually they are just concentrating on one dictator and trying to actually ransack a country simply because they want oil, or they want, and they have a hidden agenda, I believe, you know, their days in the Middle East will be, you know, difficult one, to be honest.
Now, you talk about strengthening the Israeli position by removing Saddam Hussein, and if that means that Israel is that much safer from one particular leader who was sworn to the destruction of Israel, it's really hard to find particular fault with the United States, which has such an alliance with Israel, for providing that kind of safety, isn't it?
Well, actually, I don't blame them. But if they want to have, you know, a friendly Middle East, if they want to have a passive Middle East, if they want to have also friends in the Middle East, and, you know, if they want to have Israel as the only ally and as the only friend, okay, then good luck to them. In this case, they shouldn't talk about liberation, they shouldn't talk about democracy, they shouldn't talk about human rights or human feelings. But if they want to present themselves as a liberator, as a human superpower, as a police, international police, in this case, they should start with their allies, start with their friends, start with the Israeli. Said, look, you know, okay, you want us to get rid of all your enemies, all the threats which is targeting against you in the region, and we did what you want us to do. We removed Saddam Hussein. Now it is time to deliver. We can't let you occupying the West Bank and Gaza Strip. We can't let you killing the Palestinian 10
Now is the time then for the United States to demonstrate that other side of the policy that's been talked about and promised. Abdul Bari Atwan, thanks so much for being with us. Great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Abdul Bari Atwan is editor-in-chief of Al-Quds, London's Arab language newspaper. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're going to Newton, Massachusetts now. Imran's on the line. Hi, Imran.
Hi. I guess the question I have is, perhaps, is the deep reservation and skepticism that the Arabs are feeling come in large part to the very public announcements and relationships between Israel around reshaping the Middle East. And I know that Haaretz had published a story about discussions between senior members of Israel kind of telling or consulting with America about reshaping, you know, Syria and Iran. And then also the one time, you know, very, very kind of virulent anti-Muslim rhetoric coming from Franklin Graham and other Christian evangelists who are now gearing up to come to Iraq, you know, putatively to provide aid to war victims. And
what's your question, Imran?
Well, so the question is, you know, how does the Middle East kind of view these types of very public statements that are made when they read these things?
There is, it's Michael Hudson, I mean, there is so much to draw on that, you know, if you want to, I suppose, build a front page news story out of the comments of the evangelical Christians, you can create a pretty horrific view for the Arab world. I don't know whether or not journalism plays a key role here.
you could, and it is done. It is being done, and all of these things. There's as your caller suggests, as Imran suggests, there's plenty of evidence out there for people, so skeptical people, to think the worst of us. And not only that, with the information revolution that has spread so rapidly across the Arab world, there are the means to deliver it. So there aren't any real secrets to be kept about what Christian fundamentalists may be saying to their domestic flocks or constituencies. Mm-hmm. And it's also well known in the region, just as it is well known now here, that some elements within the Bush administration, the people that are sometimes called neoconservatives or hawks or whatever, have some very ambitious plans. If you listen recently to a speech by James Woolsey, who is very close to this group and will probably play a part in the U.S. administration of Iraq, it's spelled out very bluntly. Syria will be next. Iran better watch out. And even places that are nominally friendly to us better watch out also, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So, yes, there are reasons for people out there to suspect that the conquest of Iraq may not be the end of the story of America's new preemptive sort of interventionist stance in the region.
And do you think that as the Bush administration talks about this war as a war of liberation, as a search for weapons of mass destruction, as regime change, never making any reference to Israel, and whereas Israel comes up in every reference in the Arab press, that again, this isn't even the same language that's being spoken about this war?
Well, the lonely but maybe ultimately positive role that Tony Blair has played in this basically two-country coalition of the willing is, in fact, politely to keep on insisting that the Israeli-Palestinian matter really does matter. And it will be extremely interesting to see, now that we're coming to the end of at least the military phase, whether Bush will take Blair's advice and basically ignore the advice of a lot of the more hawkish and definitely ingrained pro-Israel people that are influential in his administration.
I have to stop you there, Michael, and we'll pick it up when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Taking the temperature of Arab reaction at this particular moment in the U.S. attack on Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And as the war in Iraq progresses, we're trying to get a sense of how it is being seen in words and images that are somehow different from the ones that you may be seeing in the newspaper box beside your bus stop. And to that end, we go next to Beirut. Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Daily Star in that city, and he's on the line. Hi, Rami.
Hi, good to be with you again.
Yes, nice to hear your voice. Tell me what your lead editorial was saying today.
Well, today we were talking about really what has to happen next in Iraq, and looking very much at the issue of American credibility and consistency, as well as what the Arabs need to do, because we see this as a historic turning point. We're very critical of the war. We were and still are. But we also live in the real world, and we have to adapt to the realities, and we should try to make this an opportunity rather than just keeping it as a catastrophe, as most people around here see it.
When you talk about what the Arabs need to do and the opportunity, are you talking about the way that this particular sequence of events needs to be viewed in Egypt, in Syria, and in countries that perhaps have a citizenry capable of demanding certain amounts of change? I mean, this is the American sense, you know it well, that the seed of democracy planted in Iraq can actually affect the other Arab countries.
Well, it's kind of ironic in a way that, I mean, not in a way, it's overwhelmingly ironic that the first documented use of the word freedom in history was in second millennium Mesopotamia. So it was quite ironic that the Americans called this Operation Iraqi Freedom. They probably didn't realize that the concept of human freedom originated in Mesopotamia about 3,500 years ago. And what that's just a sort of a comment on how people around here feel, that so many of the things that American government officials are saying they want to do for us are things that we've been asking for ourselves for a long time. So the lessons are really about the governance systems, the rulers of this region, but also about the citizens and their rights, and the relationship between the two, which has been so distorted by autocratic regimes, which have been largely and heavily supported by the United States. So there's many different dimensions of life here, governance systems, American role in this region, Israel, the Arab citizens, civil society. All of these have to learn the lessons of the last 30, 40 years and to stop this terrible cycle of this kind of warfare.
But when you talk, Rami, about what the people have been asking for, and we could touch down in Damascus and speak to Syrians who'd like a better level of freedom and involvement in the running of their country, certainly people in Saudi Arabia, and we go on down the list. Mm-hmm. If we use Iraq as an example, the people there were looking for some kind of release from the hold of Saddam Hussein. They weren't able to do it themselves. So in the ambivalence of trying to figure out, you know, what the long-term effects of the American invasion will be, is the mind open to maybe this is, you know, the beginning of what was required to shake some of the other countries into the type of change that's required?
Well, I think certainly any dose of intellectual and personal and moral honesty would have to say, yes, we have to keep that possibility open. People in this region are not saying that anything that comes from America or anything that America does in the Middle East is bad. What people are saying is that they don't believe the United States really is driven by a desire to promote democracy. They would like it to be, but they just don't believe it. It's not credible because the U.S. hasn't done this for so many decades. But it could happen. And if it does happen, and the U.S. actually does do a quick exit out of Iraq, leaving in place a governance system that is legitimate and democratic and Iraqi, and then the U.S. also tries to promote those values throughout the entire Middle East and Asia and all the world, then I think you would find many people here starting to change their mind about the United States. Because we're not criticizing the United States because of something in our genes or in our water. We're criticizing the United States because of the last 3 to 4 decades of American policies that have been largely devastating for the majority of people in the Arab world. So we have to take this opportunity. Hopefully the Americans will have a more consistent and humane and legal policy, and Arabs hopefully will also put their house in order. And if the two can work together, then that would be the ideal situation.
Rami, can you stay with us a bit?
Sure.
Okay, let's go to Amherst, Massachusetts now. Jonathan's on the line. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Dick. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I'm on a cell phone. I hope you can hear me well enough. I think I want to take the last sentence that Rami Khoury just said, the Arabs putting their own house in order. I think that is the agenda that needs to be talked about. There's been a lot of nasty subtext in this discussion between Michael Hudson and the man from Al-Quds. And the subtext is the following. The subtext is that everything would be fine in the Arab Middle East if it weren't for the Americans and if it weren't for the Israelis and it weren't for this alliance between America and Israel. And I'm telling you that I think any intellectual Arab or non-Arab knows at this point that what's going on in the Middle East is the Arab rejection of Israel is not about Jews or Zionism. It's about modernity. It could have been Martians that had landed in Palestine. And if the Martians were farther advanced than Arab civilization was after 500 years of oppression under a Muslim Ottoman falling apart, failed empire, which the rest of the world was ahead of.
You're talking about just resentment, Jonathan? Are you talking about resentment of that modernity?
Resentment and blaming of and basically what I see with Michael Hudson and his attitude is that what we call in psychology coddling and enabling. What he's enabling is the misplaced resentment and the misplaced focus on the external factors rather than looking within and trying to correct things from within. And
Michael's with us here, Jonathan, so I'll let him talk straight back to you.
Yeah, sorry, Jonathan, I just don't buy it. I think it's very, you should take things really at face value. What the problem with Israel and the deeply ingrained Arab hostility to Israel does not have anything to do with modernity. It has everything to do with the seizure of Arab land and the expulsion of the vast majority of the indigenous Arab inhabitants of Palestine back in 1948 and the subsequent disasters from the Arab side that have occurred. That's what it's really about. And I think
resenting it in 1929, in 1936, far way before 1948, there was enormous Arab hostility to the arrival of an organized Jewish community in the land
of Israel.
Of
course, of course. And if they had been Martians, sure, there would still be hostility. But my point is that the reason for the hostility is the occupation and not some attribute of the society. So I think, to use a psychological term, you're engaging in a kind of a displacement to say, oh, it couldn't possibly be what everybody knows it is, but it's really something to do with modernity. I just, frankly, I'm sorry, I just don't buy it.
Rami Curry, I'd like to hear you on this because you've lived in Amman, which is a mix of a very modern and a very old city, Beirut, a bit of the same. Is this idea of modernity or the resentment towards that Jonathan's talking about something that washes in your mind?
Well, I really have to come down on Michael Hudson's side on this one because I think Michael is correct and Jonathan is mistaken. You know, we've got modernity coming out of our skin pores here. I mean, if you walk around Jerusalem or Beirut or Cairo, you've got cosmopolitanism that's so powerful and so ancient, and a tradition of pluralism, a tradition of diversity that is very impressive. The problem with the Arab world is the modern autocratic political system, and Michael Hudson has just recently written a wonderful op-ed that we're going to publish in the Daily Star in the next couple of days. I would urge readers to check it on our website, analyzing why is it that Arab democracy hasn't flourished, and he does a brilliant analysis, as he usually does. And these are really our region here is there's nothing structurally wrong with the people. There's nothing wrong with our genes. There's nothing wrong with our traditions or values. What is wrong is the distortions of our modern political and economic and military systems, of which the Israeli and the Western colonial and American interactions have been major elements. They are major elements, but they're not the only elements. And we take blame for things that we've done wrong, and we blame others for what they've done wrong. And we have to look at the Arabs, the Israelis, and the Western powers to come to grips with the totality of the problems of this region and to solve them.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Jonathan, thanks very much for that call. And Rami, I'll take this moment to thank you for joining us. It's been good to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rami Curry is executive editor of the Daily Star in Beirut. Michael, that leaves you and me. I'm interested in hearing from you about this ability of people in states like Morocco, like Syria, like Saudi Arabia, to take any kind of inspiration from what's happening in Iraq. And I mean inspiration insofar as saying, you know, that not, you know, we need to modernize or we need to change our government or its responsibility or the same thing will happen to us. But better we do what we want to do ourselves rather than have a power like America come and do it for us. Does that have any kind of grip here?
Well, I think while I'm largely pessimistic about the political future, I do think that one salutary consequence of this very bloody business that is now winding down, I hope, in Iraq, is that it will shock people in the Arab world into realizing just how dysfunctional authoritarian government can be. Now, Iraq, I think, was by far the worst case of authoritarianism that you'd see anywhere in the Arab world. It's much worse than anything you'd see, I think, in Syria or even Libya. And, you know, there may be, you know, a kind of an example. But I think people in the administration who say, once we've made a democracy out of Iraq, which, of course, is a big question, will we really do this? Can we really do this? But assuming we do it, just by its being there, do people in Morocco and Egypt and Syria say, that's the model. How come we didn't see it before? Well, I don't think it works that way, but I think what people will be thinking, and the rulers as well as the people in those neighboring authoritarian countries will be saying, look what a disaster Saddam's authoritarianism led Iraq to in terms of its incredibly stupid foreign policy, warlike adventures going back to Saddam's ascension to power back in 1979, and then look at the shock yesterday, which was truly awesome, I think, to people out there, that the vaunted bureaucratic security services in Baghdad suddenly just melted away. And you might be thinking, if you were the ruler, that maybe you can't really rely fully on your policemen and your armies and your intelligence services and your torturers when real emergencies occur. Maybe rulers ought to be thinking preemptively about trying to engage their publics in a more genuinely participatory form of government. And there's no doubt, I think, that in the, on the popular level, the Arabs must be looking, as Rami Khoury, I think, was suggesting, at their rulers and their systems of government as being so totally inadequate in so many ways, not just in terms of individual freedoms and opportunities and so forth, but in terms of the arbitrary and totally counterproductive things that authoritarian governments tend to do. And all
let
of this,
me ask you a final question, if I can, though, Michael, and we've about a minute left in the program, just so you know. In your gut, setting aside whether it's Chalabi or whether or not it's Garner or whatever happens, putting aside all the personalities, you actually believe that Iraq could stand as a representative democratic society 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now?
Oh, I have no doubt. I think that Iraq is fully capable of becoming a reasonably liberal, representative, perhaps even democratic governmental system. I don't accept the sort of Orientalist notion that Iraq is sort of less than the sum of its little parts of ethnic and sectarian and tribal animosities. The Iraqis are very capable of doing this. The problem is, how do you get there? And if the outside deus ex machina force that is delivering the opportunity to become democratic is itself regarded with great suspicion and dislike, that makes the transition process all the more difficult. But I think it is certainly possible that Iraq could become a very stable, legitimate, moderate, democratic country.
Thanks so much for being with us on the program today, Michael.
My pleasure.
Michael Hudson's professor of Arab Studies and International Relations at Georgetown University. We also heard today from Rami Khoury, executive editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Khaled Al-Mayina, editor-in-chief of the Arab News, Francis Matthew, editor of the Gulf News in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and Abdul Bari Atwan, editor-in-chief of Al-Quds, London's Arab language newspaper. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.